This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
Building Bridges had an opportunity at a Haitian independence celebration to catch up with and speak to the dean of a black congressional caucus, John Conyers.
Congressman Conyers, the last time I saw you, we were discussing the desperate need for universal health care in a single-payer system. And the time before that, you were speaking on reparations in Washington, D.C. And then the most recent time we spoke to you over the radio, you were aggressively fighting for hearings around voting irregularities in Ohio. And I say this by way of commending you on the diversity of interests and the fact that you really have been a champion in the Congress.
Well, you know, the Congress is the place that you have an opportunity to bring those kind of issues forward. The large questions of the day. How do we deal with economic issues? I remember when I first ran, I tried to sum up everything that I wrote one night, just pages and pages, but it broke down to jobs, justice, and peace. And that justice contained two parts, economic justice and social justice. And so that keeps me really aligned with the major issues of our time, actually. And so I'm glad you remember all of those, because all of those are very, very important and dear to me. And incidentally, they're all still ongoing. They're not resolved yet.
Well, since we're speaking about ongoing, I was equally thrilled with Senator Barbara Boxer. We are 100% improved over 2001 because we have one senator who stood up to deal with the issue of the franchise. Where exactly are we with that now, and what's your feelings about Ohio and the recent presidential electoral vote?
Well, as almost everybody knows, Ohio was the most flawed election for president in 2004. Last time, it was Florida in 2000. But it was the same president who each time won by one state in a highly controversial activity taking place before and during the election and even afterward in tabulating the results. And Ohio was outrageous. I'm so proud of Barbara Boxer, who served with, we served together in the House of Representatives. And she said something that was absolutely crucial. She said, we should have objected in 2000. And I think she's absolutely right. And so now we have this 1878 congressional law that was passed as a result of the Hayes-Tilden Compromise of 1877, and this is the first time that it's been used to challenge the electoral votes of a state. And I think this is historic. Now, what do we do from here? Well, we've got to hold congressional hearings, and which was the point of the challenge, on all of these issues that have been raised. And fortunately, we have put together a 101-page document illustrating the nature of the problems before the election, during the election, and even the tabulation by the computer people after the election. So there's a lot to be done. We need stronger federal laws governing the presidential election. And even though we passed a law 2 years ago, the Help America Vote Act, it is still not enough.
Speaking of congressional hearings, how determined do you see the opposition to be on the Democratic side to the confirmation of what will probably be Attorney General Gonzalez?
Well, there were good questions asked, but there was not enough firm resolve that people are going to vote against him. It's almost like raising the issue and then not putting together the forces that are necessary. If you believe that he had something to do with formulating our policy on the tortures that now everybody is disowning any responsibility for, I think we need to do more. Now, the people that are less forceful than I am about this, I say, well, but we're setting him up to make sure that he can't go to the Supreme Court. That's not convincing. We should make clear that he shouldn't even be going to the Attorney General's position.
As I mentioned, we had once spoken about single-payer system. I guess now my greatest fear is just trying to hold the fort on Social Security. Will there really be a rigorous challenge on the part of the Democrats to maintain the Social Security system and prevent its privatization?
Well, the whole notion of setting up a private account within an insurance system that's supposed to provide security and then expect that seniors will now learn how to govern themselves in a volatile stock market would be almost cartoonish, except that this administration is seriously trying to promote it. And a great number of people on Wall Street who would be advising people on how to buy stocks for which they would be charging fees are eagerly behind it. And so there's going to be a fight. But more and more people begin to realize that you can have advisors, managers, and be far less senior than those that are using Social Security and still run into a big trouble trying to manage your portfolio. We've had so many fluctuations that are unaccounted for and unexplained that to say that people would be able to pick and choose stock that would perform better than the Social Security system is almost unthinkable. But I think it will be stopped. We also have a very big problem with Medicare, which is probably needs more immediate attention than Social Security. And I think that all of this is leading more and more people under my legislation that would create for the first time a national universal system of health coverage, which would eliminate multiple payers in every state save one, insurance companies save one. We are getting more and more doctors and healthcare specialists who realize that you can't repair this safety net any longer. It's beyond repair. And now even corporations are beginning to examine the fact, take the automobile industry, where the manufacturers of automobiles in other countries don't have to worry about health care costs, the employer costs of health care, which now in many cars made in America exceed the cost of the steel that goes in the automobile itself.
Well, that single payer would certainly be a radical departure for the country and indeed even for the Democratic Party. What counsel are you giving to the leadership of the party with respect to their role in the aftermath of the election debacle this year?
Well, we're still regrouping, but there is two major directions. One is that are we going to moderate and move toward the center as a result of this election, or are we going to really go back to our base and bring forward the millions of people that have been precluded or had their votes suppressed, or that there was an attempt to minimize their participating in what is really the basic cornerstone of any constitutional democracy, and that is the right to vote and to have that vote counted.
And I know that you're in Brooklyn to celebrate the independence of the Haitian people. Certainly many would describe the situation in Haiti proper as one of occupation. How do you analyze the situation in Haiti today and what needs to be done?
Well, we've allowed this Haitian situation to turn into the kind of gunboat diplomacy that has determined our relationship in the Pacific and the Caribbean for many years. We contributed to the demise of the first constitutional democracy, Juan Bertrand Aristide, that we've ever held. And it is tragic, compounded with the natural disasters that we are now supporting the rebels that oppose the democratic government. And this is making it very clear to people that America's penchant for democracy is a very limited one indeed when it's not on our own shores.
The issue, of course, of the Iraq war, we are knee-deep in the big muddy, and the big fool says, as the song goes, to push on. Congressman Conyers, what is to be done as we get ready for this $40 million inaugural coming up, and the big fool says to push on?
The more I look at Iraq, the more it looks like Vietnam. And the difficulty of getting out gets more and more complex. And I just want to quote one thing that Senator John Kerry said that was probably the most powerful statement that I've ever heard him utter. And he said, "Who will be the commander that will tell the last soldier who has to die for this country in Iraq that it was a mistake?" And I had stayed away from my colleague Dennis Kucinich, who said we had to get out of Iraq, but I can see now that there's nothing else to do but influence it. But staying in Iraq will never settle Iraq. It will never be settled by force.
Sou te gen 24 ans pou viv, et puis nous konnen ta pral mouri. Ki sa ta fè? Yo, si te gen 24 ans pou viv, mwen ta pral cheke mami, di li te fè yon bon travay avèk premye pitit li.
And against the backdrop of Wyclef Jean, we now hear the presentation of John Conyers at the Haitian Independence Celebration that was held at the House of the Lord Pentecostal Church in Brooklyn.
Brothers and sisters, what an honor to be here, and I'm so glad that I came. Because this has been such a powerful program, I want to thank the WBAI person who is taping this entire event. This is history. These speeches have to be kept, transcribed, heard all over the world, because the spirit, the caliber, the intellect has been so remarkable that I have been really deeply moved by everything that has been said, starting with Mayor Marc Morial. And this program has just been a tapestry of inspiration and intellect and recommitment. Now, there is one person I have to single out, and that is Minister Voltaire, who is with us. He's been introduced once before. But he, to me, epitomizes the struggle in Haiti. I have to make a confession here tonight. I once, when he was in my office, I said, "My brother, please don't go back. It is your name. It would be so easy." And I said, "We can make arrangements through the immigration service." I said, "But I want you to think about this offer." And the next time I asked about him, he had returned to Haiti. And he keeps returning to Haiti. And it's that spirit that moves me to say that our job is to transform the Congressional Black Caucus to move the entire Congress, the legislative body of this country, to recommit to the freedom and emancipation of this great, powerful, historic country called Haiti, whose obligation to us and ours to them is so profound that nothing will separate it. And that's why I'm here. Martin Luther King's name has been mentioned here. And I want you to know that it was Martin whom I began to go south with as an attorney that made me understand this whole question of economic justice and freedom and how they are inseparable. And I have added to that piece. And so I came up when I was first running for Congress. Jobs, justice, and peace. And that has guided me. Martin affected me like no other leader I've ever met. Yes, Mandela. Yes, many others. But it was Martin through whose prism of leadership I began to understand that each of us can make a difference, and that it was Haiti that we persuaded, ultimately, ironically, this nation to make the transition from Cedras to a back to Juan Bertrand Aristide, and then to the tragic position which we find ourselves at this point. We can make a difference. We can make change. We can continue what Overture started. As a matter of fact, we're inseparably connected. We really don't even have a choice. And so the question is, how do we inspire as many people as we can? And we've had two great speakers tonight. One from Haiti and one from formerly from Mount Pleasant, Michigan. Dr. James Turner and Jean-Claude Martineau, I owe you a personal obligation of bringing me forward and backward into the interconnection between all of us on this globe. You see, I really have come to believe that everything is everything. That if you're fighting for health care, you're fighting for justice of minority people, poor people, working people in this country. If you're fighting for reparations, you're fighting for everybody that's owed reparations in all the nations of this planet. And believe me, there are plenty. And when we went to Durban, South Africa, for the UN conference on racism, they said, "Please, please, whatever you do, do not raise the question of reparations. Are we going to walk out? The U.S. delegation will not stay here if you do that." And they had to walk out. Because we raised it. But it was not clear to me why they put that demand on us. And it was only afterward, when we began talking with peoples of other countries, they began to ask us about reparations and tell us that they're trying to get reparations. Reparations was, unbeknownst to me, a global movement. It's worldwide. We're not only owed reparations, but more than a dozen other countries, maybe far more than a dozen. It's a concept of such power that once it's understood and spreads, we begin to understand some of the reasons that it has to be ignored. Once we understand the interconnectedness of the first challenge ever brought to an electoral vote by a state in the history of this country over a presidential nomination, and that was in the Ohio challenge, you begin to realize why so many people were terrified at the prospect that citizens and members of Congress could put together a bill of particulars of hundreds of thousands of people who were cheated out of their vote, suppressed out of their vote, intimidated out of their vote, lied to out of their vote. The laws of the country were misapplied. And then we began to realize that we had people so frightened that they would get up and speak for our challenge and then say, but I'm not going to vote for it, but I just want you to know I know how bad this was. And it would have been comic, except that it was real American history. A law never used before that came out of the Hayes-Tilden Compromise of 1877. And this law was passed in 1878. And so I've come in this wonderful honor to serve the 14th District of Michigan because I really serve the United States of America. When I cast a vote, I can't vote for the 14th District. I got to vote for a national law that will be the law of 285 million people. And it's in that spirit that I've had the privilege with many of you here to separate out some of the thousands of issues and say, look, we've got to break this thing down to something that's going to mean something, not just now, but it's going to lead somewhere. It's going someplace. And it's marching in this arc of history. And so I've been that lucky, privileged person to do that. And I come here tonight to recommit my entire being to the question of this tiny, oppressed nation in the Western Hemisphere, Haiti, a nation whose people I've come to love, whose culture I've come to marvel at, whose perseverance and commitment to themselves and to democracy is unparalleled anywhere in the world. And so I come to tell you, amidst the wreckage of the elections, that the Black Caucus is larger and stronger than ever before. Our numbers now have swelled from 39 to 43, including the first African-American United States Senator in a generation or two. And so we don't come talking about it's going to be hard times, 05 is going to be real, real tough on us. We now have seen that even in the midst of an unsuccessful election, we can regroup, we can re-examine where we're going, and Haiti must be at the top of that list of priorities no matter what we do. Thank you for allowing me to be with you tonight.
Sou te gen 24 etan pou viv, e fi nou konon ta pal mouye, ki sa ta fe, yo, si te gen 24 etan pou viv, mwen ta pal cheke mami, di li te pe yon bon travay avek kwenye pitit li.
John Conyers at the Haitian Independent Celebration at the House of the Lord Pentecostal Church in Brooklyn.
And this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report. And you can reach us at knash@igc.org. That's knash@igc.org. Building Bridges is produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.